Okay, ready? Everybody settle and action.
Warning, Critique Revolve contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended,
you're one ugly motherfucker. Go ahead. Make my day.
Well, that's great. That's just fucking great, man.
You rub the clothes on the skin, it doesn't even have
any control. Most of the night. Most of the night.
Wow!
There are
several
rules. Short round. Somebody. Very smart. Oh,
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Critique Revolve. This is another episode of Everything But the Kitchen Sink. And we are just going to have a small little discussion here. This is a more intimate. This is our fireside chat. And I say that for those who are either well-read or over 50 who know what the hell I'm talking about. But there's a candle over here, so it's where I came up with that. We are going to talk, just Mike and I here. You'll get a preview of our insane ramblings, which is what this whole show has always been. But we're in the middle of watching Oscar movies, and there's been a couple that I think we've kind of just want to talk a little bit more about than our actual Oscar shows will probably allow for, with how much time is going to be, how many movies and things are going to be condensed in that time frame. But one of the movies that we wanted to talk about a little bit was Train Dreams. Now, I will say this is going to be a spoiler-heavy discussion by its very nature, but if you have any interest, and even if you don't know what I'm talking about, I recommend you go see Train Dreams on Netflix, which is like somebody who has a PC in their house. Most of you have it. Even if you don't always use it, you have Netflix at this point. Because it is a fascinating, beautiful, tragic, relatable, heart-wrenching, heartwarming story all at the same time. I'm not even 100% certain how to truly describe it other than, and this is what I used to get another friend and coworker to actually watch it. And it's one of these, this is actually the way I used to kind of describe it to a coworker who I wasn't sure if they were going to like it. It is an experience almost more than a movie. It's something you just kind of have to sit and have it wash over you and just take it in. And I think it's something that will really resonate with a lot of people at a certain age and up, certainly, or a certain amount of life experience and up, that maybe some younger people, and to sound ageist, won't fully get. But it's one of those, come back to it when you're a little older, and it will have something for you. And I almost hate that it's on Netflix, dude.
Yeah, so do I.
Because it's going to get lost.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to get lost over time because you can't just, like, buy the Netflix DVD, which there's also a resurgence on physical media. That's a whole separate discussion.
That's the other downside of films premiering on Netflix. Netflix has exclusive rights. They do not allow those films to ever see the light of days of Blu-ray or DVD
shelves. Which is such a shame.
Yeah. I am glad to hear that you
enjoyed, and David were worried if I
yeah, I love Train like Dreams. It's one of my favorite movies of the year. Beautifully told story. It's a beautiful film. But in terms of its strategy in filming, this is an example of what so many people have been trying to do for the past 12 years and they do wrong. There's a lot of drawn out, lengthy takes, shots that just dwell on someone's face, and there's no real meaning behind it. They're just creating this emotional, existential angst.
But in a weird way, there is, for what this movie's trying to be about.
Right, because the director and the writer of this movie, they actually understood the assignment.
Yeah.
They knew that they just can't have a camera hold on someone. There needs to be a true narrative strategy behind it. And that's the difference between, say, a movie like Train Dreams and a movie like Anemone, where there's a lot of esoteric abstraction that no one really understands. I don't even know if the director understands exactly what he's doing. He just thinks it's cool. He's trying to create a mood by holding a shot for a long period of time. Train Dreams does a lot of those same things, but the difference is there's true intent and meaning behind what they're doing. And that's the biggest difference. There's not every director can do these types of movies. No.
But the thing is, like, this is another, this is going to be a dated example, but if you're old enough, you'll get exactly what I'm talking about. Anemone and movies that I don't care for that fall into that category of like long takes and artsy for the sake of it are artsy for the sake of it and don't really have anything to say, but they're trying to get this mood across. Whereas I feel like Train Dreams did a great job. It's the same feeling of when you would be at your parents' or your grandmother's and flip through an old photo album and see pictures of you as a kid or friends you hadn't seen since elementary school and kind of like go through your life page by page in a shortened period of time. And just that like wash of memories and pining for what once was, knowing you can't go back. It's a mood that it captures, I think, better than anything I've seen that tries this approach.
Well, it goes back to what I've been saying about movies and talentless directors versus talented directors. There's something that's called caliber, rigor, and intentionality. And that's what this movie has. There are other movies that do similar things that Train Dreams has done. But the difference is the caliber, rigor, and intentionality is not there.
Yeah.
That's the biggest difference. And that's why so many movies nowadays, even Hamnet, fucking want to blow my brains out while I'm watching Hamnet, because we're sitting there watching the lead character sulk for, I believe it was 5 minutes. Why are we doing this? We could have had the exact same feeling conveyed in 30 seconds.
Right.
Why are we sitting here watching this guy just go through things in one place? He's just staring off.
You know what's another thing, though, that helps that with this movie? It's an hour and a half.
It's 90 minutes. Yep.
Tight 90 minutes. What have I said, dude?
Yeah.
What have I fucking said lately? The reason I watch
and this movie feels so complete, too.
It does. Because it is. But the reason I watched this one out of all the list that I have currently to go through, I was like, well, that one's an hour and a half. I'm going to watch that tonight.
That's what I've been doing, too.
Dude, because I saw something like 2 hours and 37 minutes. I'm like,
I don't mind long movies, but when you have a list of movies to go through, it becomes a little tiresome.
But that's what I'm saying. It's like every now and then a movie used to be over the 2 hours and 20 minute mark.
Yeah.
We used to have the 90 minutes to 2 hours was what we usually kind of got. Now, 2.5 hours plus is like the average. And that's a bigger, it's just a bigger deal.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that. That extra inch is a huge deal.
It is. At least that's what the ladies say. And some men. Wink, wink.
But to get into a little bit of spoilers, so Train Dreams is the entire life story of this one man who basically was born in the later half of the 1800s all the way up until I think it's like late 60s is when he passes away. Spoilers again. This is going to be a spoiler heavy discussion. And you see how much like the world has changed. Like we think a lot about how the world has changed today in the last 10, 20 years, which is substantial. No one's going to deny that. But that's kind of in a weird way. It's always been like that. It's just been compressed more because we see this guy go from people cutting down trees, axes and saws by hand to machinery to going into space.
Yeah.
In a single lifetime.
There's a big difference.
A huge amount of stuff, but it's stretched over 80 years rather than what we kind of get, which is seems to be like a single, that kind of development in what, 20 years, something like that. The internet to today in the 30 years it's been around roughly.
Yeah. This just touches on a cultural nerve currently.
I think
as
that
well.
Too, this,
because you're dealing with cultural change, you're dealing with change.
World's changing.
You're also dealing with the elusiveness of meaning. Like, what's the point? What's the purpose? Yep. There's so many existential pieces nowadays that don't really supply you answers. They just supply you emotion. Correct. This movie is all of that. It feeds into that angst that so many people are putting to their films nowadays because of the times we live in. They're not just leaving it in some abstract setting, letting it simmer for you to kind of figure it out. They do their job and tell a story without waiting for you to figure out their own elusive abstractness.
Yeah.
They anchor the abstractness through actual meaning, dialogue, narrative, cinematography. The whole entire mise-en-scene works together to help convey meaning. Does everything correct in a time when movies do almost nothing correct.
Well, that's the thing is, like, it's weird because there's other movies I love more by a wide margin.
You mean this year or
in general? In general. I don't know about this year, truthfully. This year's been kind of... Mm.
Train Dreams isn't your typical,
it's not my typical
selection
thing.
Of film.
No, but there's like you said, there's nothing like wrong about it. And it's the one that stuck with me. And it's been a long time since movies really stick with me. I get like that maybe once or twice every couple of years.
I teared up when I was watching this movie a couple times.
Yeah. And it's one where, like you said, I think it has something to say that does have an ending message that it's trying to get to. And I think it is a great example of when art is actual art and not just lowbrow. We didn't put any thought into our symbolism because what is symbolism and subtext? We just bombard you with opinion pieces and
emotion.
And emotion. This actually is more of a what movies and good art used to be, which is a reflection of how people feel at a time that gives a sense of relatability, connectability. Like you can, I think anybody who's had a tough life, I think anybody who's suffered loss, I think anybody who's had things not work out the way they thought they would, I think anybody who's felt left behind by either time, society, the world, I think people who, like you said, are listless, purposeless, don't really know what they're here for. I think that eventually means everybody after age, 25 to after 30, you have one of those things have hit and impacted your life. You can relate to something from this movie in a human way that doesn't care who you are, where you're from, creed, color,
human experience.
It's a human movie about human experiences that everyone can sit there. And if you really sit and put yourself in the character's shoes and try to think about what it would be like to experience this. Like there's this one scene, dude, that also stuck with me. But when he's at one of his last logging trips after the fire, when he is sitting at the campfire, and he sees the younger generation of people doing it when they're using, you know, the machinery and the chainsaws and they're boisterous and assholish and arrogant and they're not the same crop, you know, that he grew up with. I have had that vibe, that feeling of, wow, I didn't even realize that now I'm on the older side of the spectrum. Not that I'm old, but like I've got more gray hair and I just worked with somebody during a video shoot over the week who is 16 years old, this kid. He's working this job that we're filming. And I'm like, I got twice his age now. I used to be closer to 18 and now I'm closer to 40 and 50. And it sneaks up on you, but it has that same, it captures that energy, that moment, that feeling of you didn't even realize things had passed or how much had passed until you really sit and look at some of it. That's hard to capture.
It is. And that's why I like how the narrative itself was constructed. It's episodic. It's the only way you can do a story like this.
Yeah.
But you are correct. It is touching on a lot of the things that people are going through, things that we were talking about before the show today, even this interconnectedness. I mean, that was one of the themes of the entire film that helped the movie stay coherent, was the idea that everything is connected. Everything works together. Everything needs the other to function and work. And once you accept that, it gives you like an anchoring to meaning.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think that's why the movie is so powerful, because it lays out a person's life, someone who doesn't really know the direction of life, doesn't know where he fits in, loses the direction he thought he was going in. And it's not until the end of his life where suddenly he realizes this is the meaning of life. This right here. Mm-hmm. Everything that I have been not looking at right below my feet, the interconnectedness, all of it. And that is such a powerful message because it reminds us to look at our life. I think there's a lot of people who waste their lives, mm-hmm. their life nowadays, and they don't really stop and think about the passing of time and the very real causal effects that they have on their environment, on others. And this movie directly relates to that notion, this idea that there's causation and everything affects the next thing. Ecological, mm-hmm. I mean, all of it, human life, it's just a
great... Our impact on the environment around us, not even just like a... And that's the problem, is that a lot of what we would get today would be harping on, you know, ecological destruction a la something like Fern Gully or Avatar to some degree.
This is
while that's not saying that doesn't, that while that's not saying that isn't a factor, this is talking about your impact on the world around you in a more real sense of like the trees
sense.
They're cutting down because he's a logger, and the house that he built and how it affected the space around that is always has been forever changed by his presence there, even if it is temporary. It's got this like grander cosmic scale of like purpose and meaning that is hard to capture. It's one of those things where I think you really do. You have to be kind of an artist with some life lived in a way. This isn't something that I think anybody who was just like in LA in their downtown apartment can write, or even if they could to some degree, it's hard to get it right in the filming and directing element. And I think that's a one thing that's been just missing a lot from some movies, especially some of the Oscar movies, is this human connection element and having something greater to say for all people who are watching it. Not this isn't for you, or the numerous, numerous articles we see of, hey, group of people, this isn't for you. That is a great way to build an audience, tell half the group to fuck off. But... You know, this is a movie about people for people.
Yes. And I think it reminds us to be humble in a lot of ways, because that's something we've lost, our humility as humans. We think we are not one with nature. We think we are above nature.
Separate.
And when you talk about the holistic quality of Train Dreams, what we're getting is this story that doesn't treat a man's life as a series of separate events. And this is ultimately the thematic strength and impact of the entire film, or the power of the film. It presents life, nature, history, grief, time, and even myth as all woven together. And that's an important, humbling thought.
Yeah.
That we are not above nature. We're not even above history. We are a part of it. All of us combined together makes up the historical footprint that all existence leaves behind.
Well, and I think it's also got a beautiful idea of someone who feels like their life didn't have any purpose or wasn't connected to anything, finds that connection to everything.
Well, that was something that was interesting, because even the smaller characters in the movie, mm-hmm. they even exemplify or emphasize that even people who are relatively non-important, air quotes, they leave something behind. We may forget who left it behind, but everyone leaves something behind.
Well, and just even little things that, again, I think kind of come with life experiences and time, of the people that you meet and the impact you have on the people around you that you may have met only briefly or for a short period of time or one summer. You know, sometimes we forget, and what we don't think is important means the world to other people. And you never really know until, well, sometimes you never really know, but that doesn't mean it's not important, you know?
And that's one of the reasons why when we talk about intention behind a movie, and we are saying that this movie is filled with intentional aspects, not just, hey, this looks cool, hey, it creates an interesting mood, but there's intention, because And well, the reason why it works is because the mountains, the forest, even the major fire that happens,
yeah,
they're not just scenery to help generate a mood. They, in a lot of ways, are characters themselves.
Well, it is. That's where he lived.
Yeah.
It's his home. It's where all his memories are.
And that's why they get away with this type of filming in a movie like this, because the story is designed for it.
Well, that's things like, let's compare this real quick for those who saw or listened to our review of Anemone. There's a scene, it's a small scene, but it really stuck with me in this movie, Train Dreams, where it's one of the flashback memories of him with his daughter by the river that's near their house and trying to get some water, and she throws the whole cup in. You know, it's this tiny little memory that it both doesn't mean anything, but also means everything. And even that river is a character in this movie from the way it's portrayed. Whereas Anemone's like, hey, here's a random giant fish. Figure it out. And then again, are you putting things in here with intention, or are you putting things in here because you think it's cool?
And that's what makes someone's movie questionable to me.
Yeah.
If I am someone who specializes in trying to analyze and understand something, and I'm scratching my head and I can't figure out what you're doing, that's a problem. I think that's an issue. And that is a problem that's happening more and more, even in mainstream things. This isn't just an art house, issue. Mm-hmm. I had mentioned the latest season of True Detective.
Oh, man.
With Jodie Foster.
I say that's the Jodie Foster one, right?
I mean, overall, the story's fine, but the story could have been told in 3 episodes because 90% of the show is mood setting. And we have to sit in it
and wait for them to catch up.
Wait for the story to begin. There is a very loose plot, if any at all. And this is what people are pawning off now as peak television. And I'm like, that's not peak television. If you are wasting 60% of your running time on creating a mood, you're not really making a story. What you're doing is the equivalent of squatting and taking a shit on canvas and then saying it's art.
Jackson Pollock?
And this is coming from a guy who likes pretentious art. You have to give us something to let us know that you're not a fraud, that you're not just being Rian Johnson from Last Jedi saying, oh, this looks cool. But what does it mean? I don't know.
And again, that's I think, just a lot of what's we've lost. And it's hard to put a word, or it's hard to describe it. It's not something you can just explain away. It's just like, it's a vibe. It's a mood. It's intentionality. It's experience. It's knowing what taps into that human soul element that we can't quite quantify. Whereas, like you said, the Rian Johnsons or the Anemone or these random more pretentious things, or just the kind of misfires that is him that we saw, the football one, where it's like, you don't really have anything to say, but you're talking. It's almost like a politician vibe where they can talk for hours and say nothing. Whereas Train Dreams, the whole script is, maybe 20 pages or something, like 30 pages of actual like written words that are said compared to everything else that you see. But it doesn't feel like it. It never overstays its welcome. It doesn't feel too long. It just feels like you get and that's the thing. It does what old movies used to do. It transports you into another time. I remember sitting there watching it and I'm thinking about myself, if I were to live in the 1800s where you only have the nature around you and candlelight and the people you're with to talk to, there is no internet, there is no phones, there is no screens, there is no games beyond what poker, and backgammon and things like that have been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's just like this quieter time where people had time to like think and be with their own thoughts that we don't really have anymore. And weirdly, conversely, in a movie, I finally felt like a little bit of that peace that you only ever get if you go camping and go on a deliberate retreat where they charge you like $1,000 for 3 days, And that's why I think it is such a good example of a human experience, a human movie. And I don't know that it'll necessarily walk away with any big awards I think it'll be a shame if it doesn't get any notoriety.
Train Dreams is the most relatable story to not just one group of people, but humanity. It's a story about the human condition in a lot of ways. And it's a shame that we don't get more movies like that. Have you seen The Life of Chuck yet?
No, I know that one, but I haven't seen that one yet.
You need to be emotionally prepared for that film as well. God. But it is a little more upbeat with a probably, I guess you can say, a happy ending. But it's very similar to Train Dreams.
That's the thing. And with Train Dreams, I don't know if I'd say it has a sad ending. It just has a real ending, if that makes sense.
It's a hopeful ending in a lot of ways.
It's bittersweet.
It's sad because we're dealing with the passing of time.
It's sad because of some of the events that occur. You know, it's sad because of the passing of time. But it's like it finds peace, like his character does, by the end. And it's one of those where I think it's bittersweet or sad in that, like someone's life, it has passed by and it's come to an end. More than it's not a tragedy, but it's sad that it's over in its own way. I know that sounds really esoteric, but I'm trying not to spoil some stuff while also give something that I think needs some more attention, some time.
Goes to show you that you don't need a 2-hour movie and you don't need an R rating to make a good film, because
really
the movie
don't.
Was PG-13 and you don't even think about it. So many people nowadays think in order for a movie to be
good awards, or taken seriously,
awards worthy or considered art, it must have an R rating on it. That's a weird thought, but it's there.
Yeah, it is, unfortunately. But
and Train Dreams defies it all.
So let real quick switching to the Oscars about that writing adapted screenplay. I haven't seen all these yet, but I've seen most of them.
What's on that list?
Begonia, Frankenstein, Hamnet, One Battle After Another, Train Dreams. Although what the hell One Battle After Another is an adaptation of, I don't fucking know. But
man, three of those movies I'm all about.
Which three?
Name the first two?
Begonia.
Begonia was fucking good.
Frankenstein.
Frankenstein, it is an adaptation, but at this point, Frankenstein is kind of its own thing, too.
What do you mean?
I mean, there's been so many adaptations.
There's been a lot.
Do we really still consider this an adaptation at this point?
So,
when there's 75,000 Frankenstein movies, is it really adaptation?
So here's the thing. I would say
or are they just remakes?
This is an adaptation in its truest sense, I would say.
It's the most accurate
to my
adaptation.
Knowledge. It is the most accurate. It is certainly the most accurate of mainstream installments. It does still take liberties. It does still change things. But I would say 85% of what's there is in the actual original novel.
And that's quite a feat.
And that is quite a feat, especially when you look at the iconic monster movie from the, 30s or 40s? Mm-hmm. That is like woefully, it takes the core concept, but it misses like everything else. Yeah. But I don't know, like, because this one, it's a tough category, certainly. But man, I that's the thing is, like, I liked Frankenstein as I watched it. But Train Dreams is the one that stuck with me.
Well, Train Dreams is a superior movie. Have you seen Blue Moon yet?
No, I'm going to watch that tonight.
I have hope. Because I'll tell you, want me to read off my top movies of 2025?
Oh, sure. Let's do that. Let's go tangent.
Okay, so my top movies of 2025, and I want to also sell you or pitch you on an idea since you are the leader of the Oscar coverage.
Okay.
Because we always have opinions and we always say, well, this other film should have been nominated or this actor should have been nominated. At the end of our second Oscar discussion, we should give ourselves 5 minutes and we each get to do two substitutes. What movie do you think should have been Best Picture? Or what actor do you think should have been nominated for Best Actor as opposed to A, B, C, D?
So, like, you take one of the ones that's in there out and replace it?
If we think there is a movie, like, let's say I don't believe this is so, but let's say Life of Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Life of Chuck should have been nominated for at least Best Picture. Well, at the end of our Oscar discussion, we can throw in that. It's like, well, okay, if I could have the power, if I can make the executive decision to replace one movie, it would be this one. Because they've missed the mark this year. Like, even though there are good films that are nominated, there are some that I'm sorry. They Hamnet, the fucking secret agent, get fucked. Oh my God. Both movies made me want to put a gun in my mouth. I'm like, why are we watching this? And they're not bad movies, but they're not Oscar films. There are so many better movies.
Oh God, that there was that one that, I don't even remember the name of it. Like the Brazil one, like I'm Still Here or something last year. Then I'm like, oh dear God.
I mean, Secret Agent isn't even about a secret agent. I'm like, I was so disappointed. I'm like, this is just about some dude who's running away. All right. So number one movie of the year.
This is in order.
I'm going to go in order.
Oh,
Blue Moon
is your number one movie of the year.
Yes.
Damn.
Train Dreams is number two.
Okay.
It could be number one, honestly. I go back and forth between Blue Moon and Train Dreams.
Okay.
The third one is Nouvelle Vague. Fourth is Frankenstein.
Okay.
The fifth is Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. The sixth is Good Boy.
All right.
The seventh is One Battle After Another. The eighth is Predator Badlands.
Okay.
Then F1.
Is that far down for you, really?
Well, F1's great, but...
Well, I know, but you talked it up quite a lot in other discussions we've had throughout the year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thunderbolts comes after F1.
And Jurassic Park Rebirth.
That's so stupid. And then The Life of Chuck. That's actually 11.
So, Life of Chuck's weird because it did technically... It came out June 6th, 2025 in the U.S., but when you Google it, it says 2024 because it was September for... TIFF, what does that stand for again? Toronto Film Festival. So that's like, I hate that shit because they fucked themselves.
Yeah.
When they didn't need to, but.
Yeah, Life of Chuck did not get enough credit, dude, even at the box office. And I think it's because it's directed by the guy that you
really, Mike Flanagan. He's awesome.
And it's based on one of Stephen King's less horrific novels,
so therefore less widely known,
and that's why I think a lot of people were disappointed when they went to go see this, because they saw Stephen King and they saw Mike Flanagan. They're like, oh shit.
Well, because
this is gonna be a horror film.
Midnight Mass in a lot of ways is kind of like Salem's Lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
I would say that was inspired by. So Mike Flanagan has been known for some of the horror stuff, you know, Haunting of Hill House, Midnight Mass, Bly Manor. Stephen King, obviously known for horror. So I think the fact that you have like these two prominent horror entertainment names with something that isn't that, in a weird way, they're both pigeonholed.
Yeah.
You know,
there is a supernatural edge to it to a degree.
Yeah. But that's not, you know, it's not horrifying.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know, man.
So that's my list. That's why when a lot of people are still talking about, like you actually, say there's just no good movies, I'm like, I don't know. I think you need to watch some more movies, because I actually feel like 2025, okay, to be fair, we have not returned to form in terms of straight up mainstream cinema.
That's when I say that, that's kind of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and that's why I bring that up.
Because when most people listening, they're going to think there's no good movies. And for the average person, I'd say, sure, yeah, there's not really much out there that I would recommend. If you're a film person, or if you are really into more niche things, there is good stuff out there. There always will be, but it's not Gladiator or Lord of the Rings that is like everyone fucking saw.
We don't have like Michael Mann's Heat. We don't have those types of films being made necessarily. But look, on my list, I had Badlands, mainstream film, F1, Thunderbolts. I'd even call Frankenstein probably a mainstream picture, Mission Impossible. So I have five films, mainstream films, that I would consider mainstream on my list. I don't feel like 2025 was horrible, but when it comes to IP and studios, they're still struggling. With certain particular films, but
well,
this is a step up though. This is a major step up. And if we continue down this trend, hopefully 2026 will be that much better.
Well, there's, I think we're hitting a cultural tipping point in so many ways, but one of the things when it comes to entertainment that I think everyone kind of has recognized, if you're into a variety of different things, you'll notice the IP soup that is everything these days. And Fortnite is the patient zero for that, where they have reached out to every single thing that's ever existed to get some cosmetic skins thrown into their
game. It's an IP whore.
It's an IP slut. Yeah. It's just fucking everything. Everyone.
It's always on its back.
Suck and fuck anything. That's what Fortnite is.
It really is, dude.
It really is. And then Call of Duty started doing that. Yeah. Magic the Gathering started doing that. You know, Dragon Ball Z is doing that. Like, Doctor Who's doing that. Every single thing everywhere is all in this weird incestuous soup.
And yet everyone's complaining about nothing original, but because everyone is original. You sent something to me a few days ago that I 100% agree with. And it was some guy yelling about.
That's usually what I send people.
Yes. It was some guy yelling about if everyone got together and say enough's enough.
Yeah.
There's nothing anyone can do. We have the power. We are more than our politicians in number. We're more than the armies in number. And all we need to do is stand up together and say enough's enough.
Enough's enough.
And I do agree with that. And the same thing can be said about all of this IP regurgitation.
Well, and I think indirectly that's starting to happen because, again, I've had this conversation of why the hell is Raising Cane's doing a partnership with the Christmas Story from 1983. I was getting a shake at One Stop, not sponsored by. So.
What a fatty.
I know, right? But
One Stop. That's a protein place.
Okay, One Stop Nutrition.
Yeah, there you go.
But there was a protein. I shit you not. I almost took a picture. A protein powder that had like a Ghostbusters promotional element to it. It was like the logo is on the fucking container.
That's so weird.
Ghostbusters hasn't been relevant since 2016 and hasn't been good since the 1980s.
And it's definitely never resonated with fitness bros.
It's so, not like, a thing. What is happening?
Yeah, I agree and that's with you on where that one.
And that whole anime discussion we had a couple weeks ago, a couple installments ago, is where I think people are not going and spending money on these things because it is just this IP soup, this regurgitation. And when something is original that comes out, it actually does quite well and people are surprised by it. Now, not everything that's original is going to do quite well, but that's never been the case. But for some reason, we are so hell-bent on it has to make money move graph up another level that we just have cannibalized everything. We're sucking the marrow from the chicken wings at this point rather than just getting a different fucking thing to eat.
Listen, we shouldn't waste.
we're beyond waste.
There's starving kids in Africa.
And even they are saying that thing is done, man. There's nothing left to be gotten from it. And that's the thing is that anything that is slightly different, and that's why I think, you know, A24 is actually doing quite well because they're at least saying, hey, this is different. You haven't seen this.
Yeah, I would agree with that. A24 takes risk. I don't know how much longer because they've had a string of box office failures, but you are right. They are the new Weinstein company.
Well, here's the thing. If Paramount and Warner Brothers and Disney and fucking everyone else can lose money out their ass till the cows come home, then A24 can do it as well with some, quote, clever accounting, I'm sure.
Well, the good thing about A24 is they also rely on film fan charity, meaning they have memberships, subscriptions, different things you can do. They are very smart with their marketing in terms of merch. I mean, they have A24 anything you can think of. The moment a movie comes out, they have a shirt for it. They have like this really cool, unique, exclusive posters or even vinyls for the soundtrack. They do really cool, creative things. That's the type of capitalism I can get behind.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that they put... They not only give you something different, but they're doing what Netflix did in some ways, what Microsoft did by getting PCs in every home. They are paying attention to their brand recognition. Even if it doesn't make money, people see A24 and it turns heads. Or people think, oh, maybe that'll be good. They have a nice clout to their name.
They have a coherent brand.
Exactly. Even if financially they don't always make enough money back or they don't do a great job at the box office, people look at their stuff and they say they're taking risks. They're making interesting things. They're making things people remember and talk about. Everything Everywhere All at Once, Uncut Gems, Lady Bird, Hereditary, Iron Claw, Talk to Me, Marty Supreme from this year's Civil War.
Breaking records, dude.
The
Marty Supreme is breaking box office records for A24.
Yeah, they have a lot of stuff that has a good name behind it. It's what HBO used to be.
Heretic with Hugh Grant. That's an A24 picture that you still haven't seen, and I'm going to punish you.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Speaking of things that interest you, you would find that movie incredibly intriguing.
Okay.
Especially with some of the things we were talking about earlier today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, dude, A24 has it down. This is what studios should be doing, as opposed to price gouging us on subscriptions.
Ugh, yeah.
So with A24, I have a membership with them. And it's like $9 a month. And you know what they do? They give you $5 credit every single month. So it's basically a $5 a month membership. And what I do in 4 months is I buy a 4K with their money that they gave back to me. I buy a 4K version of one of their movies. You also get vast discounts on all types of merchandising. That's a very smart way to market, because then you're also giving your creators, your directors, your writers a chance at it. Gaining or possibly making even more revenue from their movie through brand merchandising.
They are the new Miramax.
Yeah. They're a little better in some ways because of what they're doing with modern influencing, as well as the branding, as you were mentioning. But yes, if this is something other studios should be doing.
Well, and every year, again, even if they don't make a whole lot of money, like every year they have like something that gets notarized at the Academy Awards. Whether it's like The Zone of Interest or Marty Supreme, Everything Everywhere All at Once won, you know, they're doing stuff that is at least different and interesting. And I think that is where, especially in a world getting flooded with AI slop and just generic everything, the individuality, the human element is what's going to be the thing that champions your brand. Yeah, some are going to be bombs like The Smashing Machine, which wasn't a bad movie, but it just didn't do financially well. But then you're going to have stuff like K-pop Demon Hunters, if you go with an original thing that is Netflix's biggest hit ever. You know, you have to try something fucking different. Speaking of Smashing Machine, what did you think of Dwayne's The Rock Johnson's attempt at like a serious role?
So me and Bob have gone back and forth about this because he hates The Rock.
I know. I'm not a huge fan of him.
I don't dislike The Rock. I feel like modern rock has kind of become a little annoying, because up until Black Adam came out. Because
that was his biggest, like, I'm a dickhead.
Yeah, he was just so about this brand that he became simply a billboard. He wasn't a real person.
Exactly.
And I find it really hard to find anyone interesting.
If you're fake, you can't be interesting.
When they're hidden behind a brand.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that they don't even appear to be a real human. That just doesn't sit well with me. However, I have appreciated Rock in the past. In fact, what The Rock is doing now, Dwayne Johnson, is what he did early in his career. It wasn't until like 10 years ago that he became this guy that just does the same exact movie over and over and over, because he found something that worked. When he first started getting into movies post,
he was all over the
Scorpion King. He did some indie work and he knew how to act. He just forgot and said, hey, I'm going to hang up my acting chops and I'm just going to wield a gun and show off my muscles. That's what earns me checks.
Well, because he got like a butt fucking truckload of money from, what is it, Fast and the Furious? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was the turning point.
That was it. That's what sent him off on making like Rampage and with the San Andreas.
Yeah.
Which is like the same fucking movie.
And they're
like
all the same
3 month
movie.
Period.
Yeah. So I had no issues with going to see this movie. I actually was given a ticket. That's another thing A24 does, is they give you a free ticket for every single one of their releases. So I went, redeemed the ticket, saw the movie, and I actually enjoyed it quite a bit. I felt like he did a decent job.
I thought he did okay. I thought he did fine with a lot of it. I thought some of the really emotional scenes that he needed to do, I thought one was okay, and I thought one needed some work. But like you said, I think he has it within him to do more serious stuff and be a better actor. He just hasn't challenged himself. Like Dave Bautista has challenged himself and has really tried a bunch of different things. I really like his work, and I like to see what he does next. The Rock has not done that for the better part of a decade.
He fell into the same rut that Vin Diesel fell into.
Yeah.
Because Vin Diesel was another actor early on that did action films, but also he wanted to be regarded much like Dave Bautista wants to be regarded, as a real actor, not just someone with muscles But Vin Diesel has given up, and now he's incredibly overweight, and he's just in one franchise. So, unfortunately... Well,
Pitch Black kind of pigeonholed him more than anything.
Yeah. So, The Rock, I feel like, is a fine actor. He doesn't do a bad job. I don't think he's extraordinary. I think Dave Bautista, as you said, mm-hmm. I think he's more interesting to watch because he finds challenging roles. I feel like he's actually trying to work yes. at it. Like he's sitting there looking at this script and saying, how am I going to make this work? And he works on that character for months on end. Whereas I feel like The Rock goes in, looks at the script and says, yeah, I can do this. And then he tells the director, roll camera.
He looks at the script and so long as it's him, he's like, yeah, I can do this.
Now, overall, the movie, I liked the movie quite a bit. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the movie in itself more than The Rock, if that makes sense. I was okay with the story. It was an interesting type of underdog story that didn't really have the type of ending we thought we were going to get. Also, the chosen subject, I talked about this with Bobby a bit. The chosen subject matter is just odd. You pick a guy who's relatively unknown, mm-hmm. who lost.
Yeah.
But you also have a character who's relatively unknown, his friend, who basically went through the same problems with the early UFC, minus the drug addiction.
Right.
And he ends up winning. He's the winner of the story. And it just seems strange that you don't make him the story. And his friend, the drug addict, is part of story B. To me, that would have made more sense.
You know what did that, and essentially, in a way? The fighter.
Oh, really?
Well,
with Christian Bale and
Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
Wahlberg's character goes on to be like successful, and Christian Bale's character, his brother, is like the failed one with a drug problem.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, they kind of already had some of that, but I did think it was weird. Like, I thought his performance was fine. I enjoyed my time watching the movie. Emily Blunt is great.
So fine, too.
She's but her
so
character. Whether how much of it's true is a terrible person, I think, in a number of
her
ways.
Her terribleness made her more hot, though.
You have a problem.
Come on. Come on. When she pulled the gun out on him, I was like, oh, it's time to make love.
That's so disturbing.
Put the gun to my temple.
Oh, God. Well, you know, to each their own. I don't know what to say to that. Ryan's not here to give you a high five metaphorically. But I did have that same thought. I'm like, this story was the most interesting at the halfway point.
Yeah.
And at the end, I'm just kind of like, eh.
Yeah.
As in I hated it, but I thought it was fine. I enjoyed watching it. But it was one of those where it didn't really build to a strong act three or climax. It just kind of
fizzled.
Had to finish telling the story that it had been building up to.
Well, I think they were trying to subvert our expectations, meaning I think a lot of people, maybe. I think the director and writer was very aware that we've seen movies like this, and our expectation is that the hero, our protagonist, is going to end up being a winner. He's going to end up on top, and is actually the opposite. And then we are expected to believe that the good ending that we are given is that he's okay with it.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's one of those discussions we had earlier today, even. There's a good Star Trek story that doesn't necessarily mean it's a good episode of television. This is like an interesting story that doesn't necessarily make for a strong movie to watch come Act 3. Because the first defeat is where like you're invested in him, the character, the emotions, what's happening, the fallout from that. And then it just kind of continues on and then just kind of stops. And I think because this is what I thought. I'm like, maybe he was just the actual real guy. Mark Kerr was the one who said, yeah, do a movie about me. Whereas his friend, Mark Coleman, was the one who's like, I don't want to do a movie about me. The guy who won. So they went with the other one who did want to do it. And that just was, in a weird way, a less interesting story. But not by design.
Because
I don't know.
The best parts of the movie, in my opinion, were when the two of them were conversing. The friendship between the two of them. And maybe that's just because those are things that interest me. I love bromances. I love people that are like friends that are not blood related, that are willing to die for each other. They're there in support of one another.
In a weird way, I think had it been Mark Coleman's story instead of Mark Kerr's story, you would have had a same exact experience with a more satisfying film. Because you would have had still the friend loses, and we could have seen that, and we still could have had the drug issues, and our main character has to fly across the country to see his friend who nearly died, and it all could have worked, but it's a weird choice of point of view for a story that's interesting on its own.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly what me and Bobby was talking about. The exact same characterization of the film.
It's like watching a racing movie from the passenger seat. Like, yeah, okay, same events happen, but this is not nearly as interesting in the way. And again, that's not to say it's a bad film. I think anybody who chooses to watch it will enjoy their time with it.
I just think it's funny that the Safdie brothers, I think that Safdie brothers.
Safdie, yeah.
They were duo brother directors. They were a team of directors for two of their films. And then apparently the rumor is they had creative differences and they both wanted to take their careers in different directions. So one does, what's the name of the rock movie we've just been talking about?
The Smashing Machine.
The Smashing Machine. And the other does
Marty Supreme.
Marty Supreme. And you got, dude there's got to be some anger and aggression there.
Okay, but here's the thing. There is some anger and aggression on there, I'm sure. But at the same time, both of you made it.
Yeah, that is true.
Both of you were going to the fucking Oscars. Maybe yeah. One's for Best Picture and one's for makeup and hairstyling, but you were at the Golden Globes and you guys were at the same thing. Like, you both have made it. It's someone, I can't remember the guy's name, but it's Steph Curry's brother in the NBA? Yeah, you're not Steph Curry, but you're still in the fucking NBA, man. Shut up.
Yeah. I just think it's funny just because of the rumors that they were really at each other's throats.
Well, look at it. You know, even if they were at each other's throats, they could have been the Duffer brothers from Stranger Things and just destroyed their own career with their incompetency because one of you was actually talented because of your wife. I don't know, but I'm just saying I'd rather be with my brother at the Oscars because even though we went our separate ways, we're still doing well than be the Duffer brothers who were proven to have essentially the wife who left and then all of a sudden your episodes tank, who was your ghostwriter this whole time.
Oh, is that what happened?
There's a lot of rumors that while they were married, I'm not sure which brother it was.
Please tell me he cheated on her and he got what he deserved.
I don't know the full details. I'd have to look it up. Can you give me a minute?
Do you have it there, the information?
Give me just 2 seconds here. It's Ross Duffer had a divorce. Let's see. I'm trying to bring up his page specifically.
His name's Ross Duffer?
Yeah. So Ross Duffer was married to filmmaker Lee Janik and from 2015 to 2024. And if you look at when she left and the IMDb and like the general scores of the episodes and the seasons after the divorce, it goes down dramatically with Stranger Things. So there's a lot of people who have been having like kind of rumors was she is a screenwriter. She is a filmmaker. Was she your ghostwriter? And you guys had this like they had an idea for a one season homage to Spielberg.
Yeah.
80s retro show. Then when it blew up, it got longer, more runtime. Wife is a part of it, perhaps. We don't really know. But then when she leaves, the show suddenly takes a hard turn down the toilet.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. If you're married to someone who's in the business, you don't think you're going to talk ideas for your major show that everyone's watching?
Yeah. I mean, she could be his muse. I mean,
could be. People lose it.
Yeah. Even if that's not how he viewed her.
Yeah.
Oftentimes that is how it works, though.
Or even if it's not like how he viewed her or the emotional dealing with a divorce is not easy.
Yeah, it can sap.
So everything. That might fuck up all kinds of other things.
Yeah.
But I mean, again, Duffer Brothers with Stranger Things season 5, or would you rather be one of Marty Supreme or the Smashing Machine? I think that's a clear answer.
Yeah, without a doubt. The Duffer Brothers is actually bringing it back to the top of our show, and then we can close out, bringing it back to the top of our show. Mm-hmm. They're guilty of a lot of what we were talking about, where there are things that have no real intention other than, do you remember this? There is no meaning. The meaning behind what you're doing has nothing to do with your movie.
There is
no
meaning.
It's simply a reference to another movie that had a different meaning behind what they were doing. So you're copying something, saying, do you remember this? And then you're using it without the anchor of meaning. And that's the reason why I challenge anyone with a critical mind to go watch Stranger Things. That's why at times it feels like it's just an elusive narrative, that things are just being done because
things are just happening. There's no story being said.
There's no intention.
It's ironic. Stranger Things has a lot of things happen without really a story being told. Train Dreams has a story being told without a lot of things happening. And that
it goes to show you, if you actually understand the tools and the art, you can do a lot more than someone who has
all the tools in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, if you do yourself any favors, I'd say make sure to watch Train Dreams. It is a great experience, and it won't get the notoriety compared to some other things this year at the award show season. But it is one that has stuck with me, and I think that a lot of people will get something out of. Even if I can't quite explain it, I'd be surprised if you didn't get something out of it. So that's going to do it here for us, Critique Revolve, with this rambling thought process of just, this is what we do when the cameras are on or off, or the microphones are on or off. This is what we do all day. So thank you all for listening. Hopefully you enjoyed us. Let us know what you thought. Leave us reviews and feedback, and we will see you all next time.
Hello, very nice to meet you. I'd like to know about sex change operations.
I see.
Cut. No good for sound.
Well, fucking hell, Lloyd.
Man, game over, man. It's game over. What the fuck are we gonna do now? What are we gonna do?
Well, we're going, we don't need roads.
I'll be back.